Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
And now, a serious message from Mr. Paulson.
I think America ought to just shut up. I'm sick of this bitching and moaning.
Comedian Pat Paulson could make jokes about America. The humorless Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson can only plead with lawmakers to pass his bailout plan. When twisting in the congressional wind is no laughing matter, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 24th. And John, you think that would work if I said that around here? Just shut up, everyone.
Stop whining. Good morning, Adora.
Today, we have more details on the proposed $700 billion Wall Street bailout plan. And there are certainly many critics on both sides, the Republican side and the Democratic sides. Also today, the victims of Hurricane Ike, finally, those from Galveston will get a chance to go home and see the destruction that was left behind. The UN General Assembly is in full swing. Yesterday, President Bush spoke, and so did the president of Iran. And Rosh Hashanah is coming up. Some thoughts on food, culture, and religion.
And cake.
Those stories, yeah, cake. And those stories are coming up. But first, here are some headlines.
Let them eat cake. But first, Fed Chair Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson are back on Capitol Hill. They'll stress the urgency of their $700 billion bailout plan to the House now. They made their case to the Senate yesterday. Harry Reid, the Democratic chairman of the Senate, or majority leader of the Senate, says Democrats will not be rushed.
It's important we get it right, not get it done fast. We've been pushed into doing a lot of things during the Bush years, and any time they push too hard, it usually winds up not working out very well.
But the markets are getting a big sign of confidence from Warren Buffett, the country's most famous investor. He says Berkshire Hathaway, his company, will buy a $5 billion stake in Goldman Sachs. The markets like that. Dow futures are in positive territory at this hour.
Meanwhile, the FBI is investigating whether fraud played a role in four major financial firms at the heart of the recent instability. Investigators are looking into possible misstatements by officials at Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Lehman Brothers, and AIG. Galveston residents can officially go home this morning, though they may not want to stay. Officials there are warning people that the devastation is shocking and there's still almost no power and no running water.
He's back. Lance Armstrong, the seven-time Tour de France winner and cancer survivor, says he's ready to ride again and to raise awareness for cancer, and he wants to win some races, too.
You ever been to the Tour de France?
I've never been to the Tour
de France. It's a spectacular scene to see them ride into the Champs-Élysées.
Anybody who does anything seven times, though, I think needs to move on. but that's just me, you know? I don't ride a lot of bicycles. The UN General Assembly continues in New York today. John McCain and Sarah Palin are using it as an opportunity to meet with world leaders. Barack Obama is in Florida prepping for Friday's debate. As we said, the markets are poised to open higher. The S&P was flat yesterday. It begins at 1,188. Confidence in the faith of the U.S. government.
Do you think the government can do it? Can they fix the economy? Do you have faith in that, or do you think it's not going to happen?
If you've lost faith in the U.S. government, what does the government need to do to get your trust back? We're going to be talking about a very important story that happened 51 years ago today about some young people who really had their faith in the government tested, and the government did all right. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As in Washington, the financial bailout from the administration comes under more scrutiny by House of Representatives members who are meeting with Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Paulson. And as institutions at the center of that bailout come under scrutiny by a probe of the FBI taking a look at what was going on inside those institutions in the weeks leading up to this financial meltdown, small businesses are already feeling the pinch of so-called frozen credit markets and an inability to get loans to keep their operations going. And to talk about what's likely to happen no matter what Congress decides regarding the financial bailout is our friend Dan Gross, columnist for Newsweek magazine, who joins us from the platform of a train station in Connecticut. Am I right, Dan?
Just about, yes. That's good morning, John.
All right. I'm glad to be a part of your commute, Dan. but seriously, small businesses, and you can probably see some from where you're standing, are really in the crosshairs as people try to make decisions about their operations over the next several months.
Right. And they were already suffering, you know, before even this Wall Street stuff started. Think about how, you know, people, when they start up companies, they rely on home equity lines of credit, American Express, their Visa bills. You know, we hear so many stories about people getting started by running up their credit cards or American Express or tapping into home equity lines of credit. And basically, in the past several months, even before the meltdown on Wall Street, all those sources were being pinched because those companies in question had suffered losses, and so they were thinking, gee, maybe we shouldn't be extending so much credit to people anymore. On top of that, you know, the Federal Reserve does these surveys of banks where they say, you know, are you asking for tighter conditions or looser conditions? And then, again, in the months before this meltdown started, the percentage of people who were saying they were tightening was greater than the percentage of the people who were easing. So we had this period of very easy and cheap money that essentially has ended. And I think the lower end, the people who are not borrowing from Goldman Sachs, you know, at $100 million a pop, they started to feel it first and will probably continue to feel it a little worse.
Well, it's interesting how this goes up and down the economic chain. I mean, you described the sort of credit lines that people use to start businesses or maybe get their little film done. But you've also got McDonald's not getting a loan for expansion. That was announced yesterday. You've got car loans being denied, which has an impact on the auto industry. And the, you know, retailers need easy money to be able to get through the holiday season.
Absolutely. You know, it's working up, you know, what business people call the value chain, from the small merchant to the large corporations. And I don't think there's an appreciation of just how important credit is. You know, people like to refer to it as a lubricant of the oil. People are always, you know, if you're a big retailer, you are constantly borrowing hundreds of millions of dollars to finance your purchases and your inventory and then, you know, paying it back a couple weeks later. That's something called the commercial paper market. And it's not like people who are desperate. It's giant Fortune 500 companies. This is the way they've learned to do business in the last 20, 30 years. And when that seizes up, you know, it's very dislocating for everybody, from, as you say, from McDonald's to home builders to General Motors.
Even General Electric, which has made an incredibly lucrative business model out of selling businesses right at the end of the quarter to show a positive balance sheet, is having difficulty unloading businesses and doing the kinds of things that were so easy just even a year ago.
Not only that, but General Electric, one of its biggest units, you know, people think of it, oh, it owns NBC, it makes plastic, it makes jet engines. They have a very large unit called, it's GE Capital or GE Financial Services, where they finance the purchase of jets. They finance the purchase of their medical systems. They have a huge credit operation. And again, when they have difficulty borrowing short term, it means their customers have more difficulty buying these really big-ticket items on which they depend.
And, of course, GE was downgraded yesterday by at least one stock analyst. What do you think are the sectors that are most vulnerable going forward into the holiday season before we leave you?
Well, clearly, retail, this is the big, retail is incredibly cyclical. We think of ourselves as constantly shopping, constantly buying things. But for so many retailers, apparel, department stores, toys, you know, they do 50, 60, 70% of their sales in the last few months. So they have to make their orders from China in, you know, August, September, get them on the boat so they're in the stores October, November. So they have to lay out that cash a few months in advance and then, you know, pay it back come December or January. If they are unable to get the credit in the first place, or if they have to pay, you know, a substantially higher interest rate, it means their ability to profit or even to stock their stores in the way they have in the past is severely impaired.
Well, Dan, it gives new meaning to the word gap, I guess, as we look for the holiday season. Dan Gross, thanks so much for joining us.
Anytime. Thanks, John.
Dan Gross, columnist for Newsweek magazine, speaking to us from Connecticut. Adora?
And the problems on Wall Street and world financial troubles were certainly on the minds of many at the United Nations General Assembly, which begins its second day today. Afghan President Hamid Karzai will address the group later. But there were many looking forward to seeing what President Bush was going to say, and he spoke yesterday. For more on that, we return to Neil McFarquhar, a reporter for The New York Times, who is currently in line at the United Nations to get back into the General Assembly. Neil, how did President Bush's speech go over there at the UN?
Well, you know, the General Assembly has always been, has always had a long history of being used as a place to bash America. I mean, going all the way back to 1960 when Castro called President Kennedy a millionaire, ignorant, and illiterate. But I think the extraordinary thing about yesterday's session was that it was some of America's closest friends, allies, and trading partners that were criticizing Wall Street and the overall lack of oversight of U.S. financial markets. I mean, it started off with the Secretary General himself, Ban Ki-moon, saying that there needs to be a new understanding of business ethics and governance, and that there should not be so much uncritical faith in magic markets. And President Luiz Lula da Silva of Brazil said we must not allow the burden of the boundless greed of a few to be shouldered by all. And not everybody was critical. Some of them were just expressing concern that, you know, the financial problems are going to eat into important development programs. But the overall tone of the meetings, both the General Assembly itself and the side meetings, was one of concern.
Let's listen to just a little slice of the president's speech.
We have taken bold steps to prevent a severe disruption of the American economy, which would have a devastating effect on other economies around the world.
Was there some snickering at the notion that there would be some severe effects on economies around the world when so many countries around the world are already feeling the effects?
Well, I think if there was any snickering, I mean, maybe there was a little bit, there was a certain satisfaction among some of the attendees that the Bush administration was, you know, turning to the government to bail out, or using the government rather, to bail out the financial sector, because it had so long lectured other nations about the benefits of unfettered markets, and you know, had told people that they should, you know, let their economy, let their banks go to the wall when there are problems. So again, I think that there was some political steam being let off because America was not taking its own medicine.
This was President Bush's eighth and final address as president, as his term comes to an end at the end of the year. How do you think, is it possible to sum up his relationship with the UN and his legacy when it comes to international interactions?
You know, I was sitting next to a European diplomat when he was speaking, and when it was over, there was kind of perfunctory applause. And I said, is he going to be missed at all? And the guy just started to laugh. And I think that Mr. Bush has always had a troubled relationship with the UN. You know, he didn't go to it for the invasion of Iraq and for a lot of other international problems. In recent years, I also think that he sort of started to go back to it. And in his speech, he actually sort of said, you know, that the UN has great potential.
Very quickly, could you give us what you think we should be looking for today in President Hamid Karzai of Afghanistan? What we should be looking for in his speech?
I heard him speak a few times yesterday, and he was talking. He told about how when he was driving to the airport in Kabul on his way to the UN General Assembly. It was early in the morning, and he passed some children going to school, and you know, he was just really wanted to stress the importance of more, you know, more soldiers and more stability for Afghanistan to try and rebuild some normalcy there.
We'll be looking for more support from Hamid Karzai. Thank you so much, Neil McFarquhar from The New York Times.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
As Capitol Hill, on Capitol Hill, to get back to business today and trying to hammer out the details of the $700 billion bailout for Wall Street, it begs the question of how confident you're feeling about the U.S. government. Have you lost faith? Do you think that they are in a position to really fix some of our problems? Give us a call, 877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. You can drop us a note.
Restoring trust. And, of course, the trust in government is being tested by the people or the test of the people in Galveston, Texas. A Hurricane Ike 12 days ago hit Galveston Island. And today the lines are long as people get their first look at the devastation. Most of the residents who were forced to leave, there's a long, long line leading down the highway into Galveston. About an hour ago, residents were allowed to return to their homes in Galveston. The mayor pleading with the federal government yesterday, you might have missed it in all of the coverage of the bailout, said evoked the worst weather-related disaster in the United States, the 1900 hurricane, which devastated and killed thousands in Galveston. And the mayor also raised the question of whether Galveston should even be rebuilt at all. It's a very emotional time for these people. For more, we turn to Paul Pendergraft of KUHF Radio in Houston. Paul, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, John. How are you, sir?
I'm doing quite a bit better than you. I understand you don't have power even to this point, but let's talk about the people of Galveston. I mean, for many, there's not going to be a home to return to. Describe where that community is at this point, really many, many days after Hurricane Ike.
Well, it's day 12, and you're right. Galveston is a different place than it was 12 days ago. They're just today, and they'll be allowing all the residents who evacuated to go back and start the recovery process. And they've been chomping at the bits, as you might imagine, to get back on the island. But because of health reasons and just the sheer overpowering of the utility system, there's still no water, still no power. There's no utilities available on the island. So there's a real health concern for those that are being allowed back. They're being asked to bring rubber gloves, face masks, and personal first aid kits because there's virtually no health care available on the island right now.
And the potential for serious injury remains because there are debris piles everywhere. In fact, the most that authorities have been able to do right now, aside from some rudimentary repairs, is bulldoze debris into piles so that there are streets and actually ways of getting around.
That's exactly right. There's tons of debris, and that's one of the things that people are going to be shocked by, is that the town that they left just will not be recognizable. And a lot of the buildings right there along the edge of the water that people left knowing were there, they're going to come back, and those buildings are gone. Now, the further inland on the island you get, the houses are standing, but almost all of them sustained water damage. So people who had houses and apartments in the central area of Galveston will return to a home, but it will have had 4 or 5 or more feet of water in it with who knows what in that water. So there's it's a real disaster still.
So, Paul, it's really a go and look and see at the devastation to see what is left for what you own, because it sounds like people really can't physically stay there.
Right. They're referring to it as a look and leave policy. They want you to be able to come today. Want you to be able to come back and start gathering up your personal items, photographs, insurance papers if they're available, whatever you think you can gather, and begin your own individual cleanup process. But you're not allowed to stay. Like I say, there's no running water. They ask you to bring your own drinking water, but obviously there's no sanitary sewer. There's no electricity. So there's really no – life cannot be sustained on this island as we speak today, and it won't be for a while.
Well, Paul, I imagine it will be cathartic for residents to take their digital cameras and their rubber gloves and head back to see what the devastation is, but it's got to be heartbreaking. I mean, to hear the mayor yesterday ask the question, should Galveston be rebuilt? I mean, are residents feeling a bit abandoned by the federal government and maybe forgotten by the rest of America as we focus on bailouts and other kinds of headlines?
Well, there's an element of that for sure. We were a little surprised that Mayor Thomas even broached that question. It was one of those things where we kind of looked at, oh, did she say that? Did that really happen?
Wow.
But, you know, the fact is that it's Galveston has survived these events over the years. It will be rebuilt. And there's a real, you know, there's an element of hope that lives in this darkness down here. People do recognize that that there's a lot to be done. And, you know, with the news of the bailouts in the billions, there is an element of like, hey, what about us? But, you know, there's an independent streak as well. This city is going to be rebuilt. It's going to be better than it was. There's no question that people are going to come back. Life is going to return to what can be identified as normal at some point. And sadly, in another period of time, another storm will come visit us. So there's a cycle, a circle of life that we have to live with.
Well, you mentioned the billion-dollar estimates of repairs. Remember back when a billion seemed like a large number, Paul? Remember those days? When are you going to get your first look down there, Paul?
Well, we had some people there. They've allowed the media on the island, and I have friends who live on the West End, and they've been able to go by boat, actually. They took a boat ride across the bay, and they've taken some surveys. So probably within the next week, everybody who has property on the island will have had a chance to survey it. And you mentioned it earlier, John. There is a cathartic need to just experience it firsthand. You can be told the damage. You can see the photographs. But until you touch it and smell it and wade through it and start cleaning it up yourself, it really doesn't, that's not personal.
Well, it will be personal today, though, as people stream back into Galveston. Paul Pendergraft is a senior producer for news and public affairs at KUHF Houston. And now, headlines for Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much. Coming up to 28 minutes past the hour, the Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson go back to Capitol Hill today to tell skeptical House members why they have to act fast and approve their $700 billion bailout plan. The Fed has ploughed another $30 billion into overseas money markets. It's part of the effort to shore up global markets. It's in addition to the $100 billion the Fed and other foreign central banks pumped into markets last week. Convicted killer Troy Davis was just 2 hours from being executed last night in Georgia when the U.S. Supreme Court gave him a reprieve. And another story making news this morning, the FBI are investigating 26 financial institutions. Now, a government official who wanted to remain nameless says that it was illogical to assume that the companies include Lehman Brothers, who went bankrupt recently, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They had a government buyout of $100 billion each, and AIG Insurers, who had an $85 billion loan.
So is this a look at spin that investment companies use to sort of say things are great as possibly a case that they're misleading their investors or misleading the economic authorities?
Mr. Mueller from the FBI was saying that it's just preliminary investigations, but it looks like misstatements may have been made to investors. So spin is good summary of that.
Interesting, John. Interesting. Very complicating to the hearings on Capitol Hill today. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, probing topical issues such as mothers who meet at a bar for drinks and bring their babies. Is it fair to the other patrons? Is it fair for bars to prohibit them? Conversations found at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Certainly confidence in the faith and backing of the U.S. government is a theme of the current financial crisis. Have you lost faith in the government? Faye wrote us an email and said, we're giving an unsupervised, no-strings-attached $700 billion check to the people who brought us Osama bin Laden, Iraq, Katrina, and an unfettered financial market. Hey, I've got a bridge to sell you, Faye writes. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Do you think it's all con men or what? At MyTake at thetakeaway.org.
And we're going to stick with some politics. We're going to take a look at the 2008 presidential election. The whole election is in full swing, but our takeaway contributor and senior editor from Essence magazine, Patrick Henry Bass, has noticed something, that one influential group has been pretty much silent this year so far, and that's black preachers. Traditionally, the black church has really played an important role in energizing the Democratic base and getting voters to the polls. But with Barack Obama as the Democratic nominee and historic first, is the black vote locked up, or is there some small percentage of African-American conservative churchgoers who perhaps might support McCain? Patrick, will you explain this dynamic between church leaders and conservatives?
Sure. Well, right around this time, 2004, you would see, you know, African-American ministers like Reverend Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton with a very uncomfortable-looking John Kerry, you know, in African-American churches trying to rally the African-American vote because it hadn't been locked up. It's different this year because a lot of African-American politicians and preachers were for Bill and Hillary Clinton and tried their best to get their parishioners to go along, but they didn't drink the Kool-Aid this time. So, you know, that threw a whole monkey wrench into into what the African-American vote or voters were going to do. So it's the first time that we've ever seen a break with African-American parishioners with their pastors, except for one group, and that is African-American evangelical Christians.
And explain the relevance of the religious issues
Sure.
that have concerned the pastors the last 8 years.
Well, sure. Well, this could possibly be the huge October surprise for the Obama campaign. I don't think that this was something that they saw coming or that they counted on. And that is that George Bush got 11% of the African-American vote in 2004, which is quite significant. Those are huge numbers. We're talking thousands of African-American voters. The thinking was that John McCain had no support within the evangelical community, and with the nomination of Sarah Palin, the choice of Sarah Palin, she's speaking the language that African-American evangelicals right. like. And the Republican Party has tried, you know, for the last 8 years with their faith-based initiatives and compassionate conservatism to try to build African-American leaders within the black church. It's been unsuccessful thus far, but there is a guy named Harry Jackson Jr., who does a lot of appearances on shows like TBN, Trinity Broadcasting Network, The 700 Club, that
Focus
is watched
family,
by a
right.
lot of African Americans. Yeah. My folks in Laurinburg, North Carolina love this stuff, you know. And I'm looking for Sarah Palin to start making appearances in the African American church. People laugh about that in the office at Essence, but she's not going to bring moose stew to an apostolic church.
Right.
But I'm looking for her to make an appearance because I think that she would be far more comfortable in that church than Joe Biden or McCain, and even Barack Obama.
Well, let's note two things. I mean, the 11% number that you spoke about is even more powerful when you note that it breaks in battleground states.
Absolutely.
And so that even makes it more of a multiplier. But the other thing is you didn't mean, I'm sure, to describe African-American evangelicals as members of a Jonestown cult when you said drinking the Kool-Aid.
Oh, I did not.
But I know that you didn't. But describe the calculation here. What is the calculation that pastors are making? They're not saying that Barack Obama is not Christian in some way, are they?
No, but they're going to values, John. Uh-huh. They're going to values, and thank you for the Kool-Aid thing. They're definitely going to values, especially on issues like gay marriage and abortion. You know, and those are just huge wedge issues that the Republican Party has been brilliant at taking emotional issues and politicizing them, especially with African American voters. And Barack Obama has been, you know, he's been backtracking on gay marriage, the gay marriage issue, somewhat, but it's not enough for evangelical Christians, especially evangelical African American Christians.
So you're saying, in some sense, these voters are perhaps out of reach of even Barack Obama?
Possibly, potentially.
So, so strategically, what can the Democrats do if they really want to go here, or do they just sort of compensate somewhere else?
Okay, to be corny, one could say pray, right? You know,
no. But your parents would not think that's corny, Patrick.
Yes, Patrick, being patronizing is not necessarily helpful.
No, I think that what Barack Obama has to do is continue to speak to his faith, and he has gone on the record to say that he supports faith-based initiatives, and he feels that the Bush administration has bungled them, and in many instances they have. Now, if they do have someone like Harry Jackson who has benefited from those faith-based programs out there berating or attacking Obama's message, then they may kiss that African-American evangelical vote goodbye. And again, those are thousands of voters.
And everyone talks about how critical it's going to be for both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party to get their voters to the polls, period. Now, the black church has always been a real center of energizing, organizing, and getting people to the polls. Do you think that's at risk this go-around?
Well, what may possibly happen is that some of the ministers may tell the African-American evangelical Christian to stay home if they're on the fence. You know, we do know about the 1992 campaign with Florio and Christy Todd Whitmer, where Ed Rollins, said he did or didn't, you know, pay African-American preachers to tell their flock to stay home.
There were accusations,
allegations that there was $500,000. Then they would say he went into spin mode. That could possibly happen as well, come this election.
You know, let me just ask you one quick thing. You're talking about intangibles and interesting dynamics that are sort of below the surface in the African-American community. On the other end, you know, you hear talk of this. Is there fear of Barack Obama actually getting elected that might affect voters? In other words, the idea that as tangible and historic and emotionally involving as having an African-American president, there's also a fear of some sort of backlash in the United States?
I'm sure it's out there, but I've not witnessed it yet. I've not heard anyone say that. I mean, I know African-Americans who are on the fence about Barack Obama, believe it or not. When we were down in Denver with the takeaway, there were many people at the Denver Hair Works who were on the fence, around those values issues. So I don't think that they think that there's going to be a backlash or that there's going to be some, you know, bomb dropped on African-American community or anything like that. It's just something
that
we've never
experienced before. During the primary process, we were hearing things like this. We were actually discussing it in our editorial meetings.
Yeah, that's gone. I mean, I don't think that sentiment is there, but I do think that the Obama campaign miscalculated when they thought that the African-American vote was sown and locked up.
Patrick Henry Bass, many thanks to you. We're going to ask you to stick around. Patrick Henry Bass is our takeaway contributor and a senior editor at Essence Magazine. Right now, we're going to turn to Femi Oke for some headlines.
Thanks, Adora. 20 minutes to the top of the hour. President Bush ends his three-day trip to New York today. He met with the Iraqi President Jalal Talabani last night and formally thanked U.S. allies involved in the Iraq War. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson are back on Capitol Hill this morning to testify before the House Committee. Earlier this morning, we spoke to the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, Barney Frank. He explained why the bailout was so crucial.
You know, we're not just talking about Wall Street. We're talking about auto loans being cut off, about people not being able to finance inventory, about people not being able to buy furniture, and all the impact that has on the people who are in the business, the salespeople, et cetera.
Congressional leaders and President Bush say a bailout plan for Wall Street will pass, but there will be significant changes to the plan as it was introduced. We'll keep an eye on that this morning.
Thanks, fam.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
Part of my job, I think, as president is to make government cool again.
That's presidential candidate Barack Obama, of course, and one of the themes of this campaign has been the restoration of confidence in government. Sounds like an abstraction, a bit of a platitude, government being cool, but confidence in the U.S. government is a real theme of this current financial crisis. Does the U.S. government back up what it owes financially, what it believes in principle? Well, 51 years ago today, the confidence of the U.S. government was tested in a way that defied all platitudes and abstractions. Nine courageous black students in Little Rock, Arkansas, had to ask themselves if they believed the federal government would back them up if they simply exercised their right to get an education. Little Rock Nine were a group of African-American students who were enrolling in the segregated, all-white Little Rock Central High School. They had the backing of President Dwight D. Eisenhower.
I have today issued an executive order directing the use of troops under federal authority to aid in the execution of federal law at Little Rock, Arkansas.
Listen, everything around these students said they were not welcome. The authority of the state of Arkansas was arrayed against them. Arkansas Governor Orville Faubus evoked a higher authority than the federal government.
In the name of God, whom we all revere, in the name of liberty we hold so dear, in the name of decency which we all cherish, what is happening in America? Is every right reserved to the states by the federal constitution now lost?
Consider how much faith you would have in the federal government to run this gauntlet to go to school. Sure, soldiers from the 101st Airborne were there to enforce the federal order, but Washington must have seemed very far away to the 9 black students facing white students who, as you can hear, openly opposed integration.
They've got their schools, and they can go to their own schools. Because we ain't going over to their schools to start anything with them, and they're not coming over here and starting anything with us.
But this first moment of integration in U.S. education would lead to a social and political revolution, which you can hear in some of the students who spoke that day.
This boy was sitting by himself. The whole table was cleared. Mm-hmm. This white girl and this white boy of very high standards got up and went over and asked the Negro very politely if he would like to come and sit with him. Because if I was a white student and I was asked to go to colored school and I was sitting at a table by myself, I would want to be taken in because I would feel like an idiot just sitting there.
That social revolution could not have happened had not some young kids 51 years ago today believed in the full faith and credit of the United States government. Here's one of the 9, Ernest Green, speaking last year to CBS News.
Given that we had spent 3 weeks trying to get into class, the fact that the federal government was going to use all of their might to help us get into Central High School was a terrific feeling.
More than a feeling. 51 years later, candidates from both parties plead now with voters to find a way to restore confidence in government.
Americans are hurting very badly. We got to reform government. But right now, we have to restore trust and confidence in government.
If it weren't for government, then we wouldn't have a Civil Rights Act. And so part of my job, I think, as president, is to make government cool again.
True. But thinking of the tension and courage it must have taken for the Little Rock Nine to simply go to school, maybe we can aim higher. Maybe we shouldn't settle for government to be simply cool. Give us something big to aim for.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We have the latest headlines for you at this hour. Anyhow, Femi Oke is here.
Thanks, Adora. It's 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson are back on Capitol Hill today to make their case for the administration's $700 billion bailout plan. President Bush gave his farewell address to the UN General Assembly yesterday. He assured world leaders that the US economy is on the mend. John McCain and Sarah Palin are also in New York. They meet with several world leaders at the UN today. And Barack Obama is still in Florida. He has no public events as he's preparing for Friday night's debate. And finally, pretty much the theme music for Yves Rossi. He's the man who has pioneered human flight. The Swiss daredevil is often called the Rocket Man for his impressive flying equipment. And today Rossi will attempt to cross the English Channel from France, propelled by a jet-powered wing, which is strapped to his back. The 49-year-old airline pilot has some expertise, so he's planning to drop from a small aircraft above Calais in France at 8,200 feet before spreading his wing, and he should reach speeds of about 125 miles an hour as he heads for Dover. That's on the coastline of the UK.
He can just drift in from that distance.
125 miles.
It'd be a challenge if it was... It was like
you're gonna try it, John?
To Gibraltar or something.
He's got a 30-liter fuel tank, and that gives him 10 minutes of power. So yeah, he's pretty close. But but flying is flying.
Right. Is he often called the Rocket Man or just today?
He's called the Rocket Man pretty much every day he's flying. Do you doubt me?
Thank you.
You doubt me?
Thank you.
You're
welcome.
Speaking of Rocket Men, no, that's really not my transition. We're talking about confidence in the U.S. government as lawmakers on Capitol Hill debate the bailout package for Wall Street. What's your thought on how trustworthy those government officials are?
Hi, my name is Ben from Jersey City, New Jersey. It's really tough for the government to protect you when their interests are getting in the way. But, you know, every 4 years, we get a chance to poke them with an election year like this. So I say to everybody, get out there and vote and, you know, poke them where it hurts.
There's our takeaway for today. Poke them where it hurts. We want to hear your thought on how trustworthy is the federal government? How much do you trust them to fix our economic woes? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
Cynicism. But Patrick Henry Bass is still with us. You know, the challenge happens every year during every holiday. Comfort demands that holiday food be the same as mom made it from year to year to year. But being an innovative cook demands that you sort of mess around with the recipe. We eat iconic foods of the holidays year in and year out. But is there a way to innovate without throwing the tradition out the window? Melissa Clark, New York Times food writer, is with us, who talks to us just in time for Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. Thanks so much for being with us, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
And there's a team of people preparing various things that I can't even see over the computer screen here. But
and
I
smell
sense
wonderful.
There's cake here.
Because Melissa brought treats.
All right. Melissa brought treats.
We never travel without treats.
We love treats. So the premise of your piece that we're going to discuss is, how do you innovate? The challenge of innovating holiday foods that are so, you know, bound in tradition.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, every year, we all, no matter what the holiday is, we all expect the same dishes and we look forward to them. I mean, if it's Thanksgiving, it's cornmeal stuffing. If that's what your family does, mm-hmm. in a big turkey, cranberry sauce, sweet potatoes. For Jewish New Year, which is Rosh Hashanah, which is next week, our family, we're from Ashkenazi heritage. It's brisket. And every year for the past, as long as I can remember, my mother has made the same brisket recipe. And I love it, Mom. Love the brisket. But
your mom listening, Melissa? Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
She's starting to cook it now. It'll be done in 3 days. Right?
She does cook it in advance and freeze it. That's her thing. But this year, it was up to me to cook the meal. And I thought, okay, finally, I'm going to take control and I'm going to do something different. And I really wanted to do something that wasn't going to freak out the family, that wasn't going to be too crazy, like I'm not going to do a big... I don't know. It seemed like it needed to have some roots in my Jewish heritage, but not be the same old thing that we have every year. And for some reason, I got really focused on osso buco. It's like, osso buco, it's the perfect party dish. You can make it and feed a lot of people at once. And it's,
let's just tell people, osso buco, of course, is a veal shank, right?
It's a part braised veal shank.
Right. That's stew.
Exactly. And it's the kind of thing, like brisket, you can make a lot of it. You can even put it in the freezer. But it's not really, it's an Italian dish. It's from northern Italy. It is not Jewish. And I was racking my brain, well, what can I do to just kind of give it a little bit of Jewish tradition? And the thing about Rosh Hashanah is that you're eating traditional foods that are a little bit sweet. For the Jewish New Year, you want to welcome the New Year in on a sweet note. So apples dipped in honey is very traditional. Mm-hmm. If you have your brisket, you also have something called tzimis on the side, which is sliced carrots. And carrots are, you know, very sweet, and you can add prunes to them. And I thought, why don't I make the osso buco a little bit sweet? I'll just add some dried apricots. I'll add some fennel. And that'll just give it that kind of, to me, like a Jewish taste, a New Year's taste. So I called an Italian chef, and I started giving him my ideas. I'm like, what do you think? This is Marco Canora at Insieme, which is a fabulous mm-hmm. restaurant in Midtown. What do you think of my idea? I'll make osso buco, but I'll make it sweet. He held his breath. And he said, I don't know about that. And then finally I realized, you know what, I'll just stop calling it osso buco, and I'm just going to make veal shanks with these apricots. It's going to be braised with fennel. And I did, and it's fabulous. Right.
And
so that's how I got there.
What does your mom
think
of it, Melissa?
My mother was, she was happy I was cooking. She, let's just say that.
She was, wow, that's great. What are the limits, though? I gather you can't do, you know, mushroom chipotle stuffed brisket and get away with that.
That's
right?
The thing. Well, you could, but you don't want to be too radical. Right. At least I think most families want some link to the past, because that's what you're looking for at a family gathering during a holiday is tradition, right? You want to have a link to cultures that have come
before
you.
Well, it's so much about these events, these holidays are so much about that shared experience,
exactly.
Right? It's about the shared expectation. It's about honoring, you know, the very specific priorities, whatever they may be, like you were saying about sweet. I mean, that
yes.
The
right.
Sweet notion of Rosh Hashanah is really important to the holiday itself, about the new year, right?
I think there's something about flavor and there's something about eating that is so core to identity that if you don't taste those same things year after
right.
year, you really do right. feel a lack.
Yeah, Patrick, what's untouchable in
well,
your
holiday? Last year, my Rosh Hashanah experience, we had sweet potato rugala.
Oh, there you go.
No,
potato.
I'm just kidding. We did
that. Like sweet potato rugala, I'm going to make that.
Sounds good.
But I mean, New Year's in every culture. I think in every culture, for New Year's, you have something very symbolic. You have a food like... depending on what your culture is. Like, for Patrick, like, how do you celebrate just regular New Year's, you know?
Oh, we do ham hocks, which I'm sure is very popular in Jewish communities. Right,
yeah, exactly. although, you know, Christmas is such a big meal in our family that New Year's is often, like, leftovers.
Yeah.
You know, so
yeah, I would say Thanksgiving is big in my household. Potatoes. But then my mother's Irish, so
right.
you
well,
kind
so
of
there
have
you go.
Potatoes with every holiday. And then there's some more potatoes.
So what is absolutely, I mean, if you go home for the holidays, Patrick, what do you, if your parents don't cook it, what really breaks your heart?
The mac and cheese.
Right.
Yeah. And like no one can add peas to the mac and cheese
yeah.
at the family
yeah.
reunion. You
right.
can't mess it up.
Yeah.
You know? You can't look at a recipe in Ladies Home Journal and add that and bring it to the family reunion or you're disowned. You can't come back.
I mean, I'm telling you, when my mother started doing cornbread stuffing in the turkey, our family practically revolted. It was just bread stuffing or nothing, Mom, and she really had to fight us.
Yeah, you see, that's the thing. I mean, you have to feel bad for those cooks every year who have to make the same thing. Otherwise, their family is going to come up in arms. But listen, I want you guys to try this.
Yes,
okay?
yes,
because
yes.
Because
yes,
I see everybody
go.
Eyeing the cake.
I know.
It's all right, so describe this cake here. Describe
okay,
this
so
cake.
Another thing, apples and honey are very traditional New Year's flavors, and I made an apple honey cake. And this is not a traditional cake. It's actually, it's a Southern recipe I got from a long series of events. It's an apple walnut cake, and I added honey to it just
yummy.
To make it easy.
Now, can we podcast this cake for our listeners?
Oh, I think there's a link on your website somewhere for the recipe. The trick is I use chestnut honey. So
oh,
it's a very
that's
flavor.
Delicious.
It's a
so
flavorful
good.
Cake.
Oh, that's fabulous.
And it's great for New Year's. It's really easy to make, and it keeps in the fridge.
Oh, boy, I can't even thank you enough. Mrs. Clark, thanks so much for bringing your cake to us and all of your good suggestions. New York Times food writer, and of course, our friend Patrick Henry Bass. Thanks to both of you.
And my takeaway is chestnut honey. You got to check that out because this cake is great. It'll be on our website. And if you missed any of our Wall Street bailout coverage, you can catch up with us on iTunes. You'll also find a link to our friend feed page and our video podcast on our homepage. That's thetakeaway.org.
Yes, and you can see people here in New York asking for $700 billion. We were out doing that yesterday. Today we're talking about turbulent international markets, black preachers, and the election, and shaking up traditional holiday foods.
Here's your takeaway for the day.
But until you touch it and smell it and wade through it and start cleaning it up yourself, it really doesn't, it's not personal.
That's Paul Pendergraft, senior producer for KUHF in Houston, talking about what Galveston residents will be coming back to their homes today after the town reopens following its hit by Hurricane Ike.
By the way, if you're not sure what you think about the candidates, we can help you. New tool on Facebook, who should I vote for? You enter three qualities you'd like in your next president, and the community of Facebook users will give you some suggestions of who you should vote for. It's a way of taking the pulse of the candidates and also your community. There's a link on our homepage, thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
A question for the congressman from Massachusetts.
Yeah, my name is John O'Brien. I want to ask Barney Frank how much responsibility he takes for all this by forcing banks to give loans that to people that would have never qualified under the old standards.
Barney Frank will answer that question on our program this morning. The Democratic chairman of the House Financial Services Committee will also be posing questions to the Bush administration on Capitol Hill today. Barney and the bailout in the House. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, September 4th, 24th. And John, I just want to let you know I'm in the House.
All right, in the House. Adora's in the House. Good morning, Adora.
Congressman Barney Frank, he is at the center of the $700 billion Wall Street bailout, and it's certainly a heated debate. We'll have a report on that. Also, advertising in the presidential election is getting tougher, especially from political action committees. The Supreme Court and U.S. foreign policy will discuss the connection. And in Brazil, infanticide charges against ancient tribes, well, it's triggered a major controversy. Those stories are coming up, but first we have a few headlines.
Fed Chair Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson are back on Capitol Hill today. They'll stress the urgency of their $700 billion bailout plan to some skeptical House members. They made their case to the Senate yesterday. While Congress hammers out the details, the Fed is injecting another $30 billion into overseas money markets, and that's on top of the $180 billion the Fed and other foreign central banks pumped into the markets last week.
Those are some big numbers, and here's another one. Warren Buffett sees a buying opportunity. He's snapping up $5 billion worth of Goldman Sachs. The markets seem to be reacting well to his show of confidence. The Dow futures are in positive territory. The FBI is looking into whether officials at four major financial firms deliberately misled investors. Investigators are looking into possible fraud at Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, Lehman Brothers, and AIG.
Residents of Galveston, Texas are making their way back home at this hour. Official Danny Weber says they're prepared.
We'll have this island ready for residents to come back. We'll not be 100%, but we'll be in good enough shape for our residents to come back.
Residents who do return to see the devastation of Hurricane Ike are being asked to bring their own water, gasoline, and first aid kits. Lance Armstrong is back, not in Galveston. The seven-time Tour de France winner and cancer survivor says he's ready to ride again to raise awareness for cancer and to win some races, too.
And here in New York.
Marry some other people.
You think
too?
He's going to.
I don't know. I don't get me started on Lance Armstrong?
He's kind of marrying people?
He's a serial spouse, isn't he?
No, he's been married once.
Oh,
I think he's had a few girlfriends.
All right, maybe that's it.
Okay, there we go.
Way more than me.
I don't even know how to respond to that.
Apparently not. She
okay, here in New York City today, the UN General Assembly continues, and John McCain and Sarah Palin will be at the UN to meet with some world leaders. Barack Obama is still in Florida, apparently prepping for Friday night's debate, the first presidential debate this year.
So the words Lance Armstrong just shut you down.
I had images of being in Paris at the Champs-Élysées when he won his sixth title.
Champs-Élysées.
No, it's an incredible. I was not a racing fan, but once you see these guys after 3 weeks of bicycling, they come in and they're just pumping away on those bicycles. It's pretty spectacular.
You know how to reach us. 877-8-MY-TAKE. What's your confidence in government right now?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. More details, defense, and debate about the $700 billion bailout that the administration has proposed to save the world's financial system. It was discussed yesterday in front of the Senate. Today, Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, and Treasury Secretary Paulson go before the House to explain and defend this plan. Joining us is Barney Frank, the Democratic chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. He's on the phone from Washington. Congressman Frank, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Congressman, I have one question, and then we've been soliciting questions from our listeners all week, and I want to give some of those to you. First, you've been talking in public statements and at least news reports of the negotiations that have been going on that it's very important to get some sort of asset position for the U.S. government, that they, in acquiring so-called distressed assets, that they may end up taking equity positions in some of the companies one way or another. How is this different from the nationalization of the financial sector, as some Republicans have described?
Well, what the Republicans are describing, of course, is a recognition by some Republicans, not all, that the extreme non-intervention doctrine that they posed, ironically, is now leading to a greater intervention than we've ever seen in the private sector. But secondly, nationalization means you take over the company. You run the company. In some cases, it means you don't compensate the owners. We are talking about the government taking a minority position and not voting the shares. That is, we are talking about having the program be used in some cases to buy a percentage of a company, a fairly small percentage, and in a way that does not allow us to vote. We don't want the government being a decision maker in these companies. And we do this because the argument that Mr. Bernanke and Mr. Paulson are giving, with President Bush's approval, is that we have companies that have so screwed up themselves, and this is the irony, that the whole economy is suffering because they've stopped lending. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're not just talking about Wall Street. We're talking about auto loans being cut off, about people not being able to finance inventory, about people not being able to buy furniture, and all the impact that has on the people who are in the business, the salespeople, et cetera. So we are saying that one of the things they should do is to take a position in the companies, because if you do that, what we are saying is we will do that with a requirement that if that company subsequently becomes very profitable, there's what we call a warrant, so the federal government, the taxpayers, get something back.
And but that's what happened. That's what happened in the Chrysler case,
exactly.
Right. Yeah.
But what we're talking about is taking a very small position, a very small percentage, and it being non-voting. So that's hardly nationalization.
From Arlene in your state of Massachusetts, do the Democrats have their own team of experts to analyze the problem, insist on key components, and make sure the taxpayers don't get saddled with the costs of Wall Street mistakes?
Yes. We have been working closely with, for instance, former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, with Alan Blinder, who's a professor at Princeton, who was the vice chair of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, with Paul Volcker, with Laura Tyson. I've myself spoken to a range of people, to George Soros, I spoke to Professor Jeffrey Sachs, and we are in regular contact. In fact, Speaker Pelosi had a leadership meeting the other day where there was a long conference call with several of these people there. We've spoken to people of the AFL-CIO. I've spoken to Andy Stern most recently from the Change to Win operation. So
you've got some experts.
The other thing I would say is this. The taxpayers are being saddled to some extent. We can't avoid that, but here's the problem. And I think, you know, we are debating the consequences, and it's a mistake not to remember the cause, even while we have to debate the consequences. The cause is the Republican philosophy of complete lack of regulation. Look, Ronald Reagan articulated it when he took office in his inaugural, his first, and he said, government is not the answer to our problem, government is the problem. And then during the 12 years of Republican domination in Congress, the majority leader, that one of the chief economic spokesmen, Dick Armey, used to say, government is dumb and the markets are smart. So, yeah, this philosophy of no regulation did allow enough mistakes to be made, so we're all in some trouble. We're trying to minimize the risk to the taxpayer and expand the benefits that will go across
the
board.
Right.
But we do have a problem that we inherited from this conservative philosophy.
And Congressman, that irony that you just laid out is certainly not lost on many of our listeners who also had some questions about the constitutional issues. Here's David Merkel.
Hi, this is David Merkel. I have a question for Representative Frank. With the current plan, Treasury has little accountability to Congress or the judiciary. Why would Congress abdicate its constitutional role as guardian of all spending by giving the Treasury carte blanche over an amount that is a sizable fraction of the current budget?
Congressman?
The answer is that we won't. Called me last night, one radio show, and I heard the lead, and it said, the question is, will Congress give the Treasury Secretary untrammeled authority? And when I came on, I said, I think we're going to trammel him. the fact is, that we have rejected those parts of their draft which exempted him from judicial review. That is out. We have worked very carefully with our lawyers, and we have the speaker has appointed her own counsel, Joe Arnick, who had been a clerk to Justice Brennan and an activist in the right kind of the legal profession. And we will subject the secretary in this under all the law restraints that he should have. Secondly, we are creating an independent oversight board that will be appointed not by the administration. It has to be oversight, because if you don't have a presidential appointee, they can't have operational control. But this board, every single transaction, I mean this literally, every time they buy anything, they're going to have to submit that to the board. This will be an independent board with its own budget and staff to analyze this. We've also asked the Government Accounting Office, a very good independent organization, to have a major role in monitoring this. So we are going to give them a great deal of oversight, and we are going to give them a great deal. He's going to have the normal legal scrutiny, and it's
that's
still
the trammeling. That's the details on the trammeling. Dora, you have another question?
Yeah, and just to get to another issue that's been heatedly debated, and that is about executive compensation. What do you say to the Secretary Paulson's notion that if you try to put any limits on that compensation, that many companies will not participate in this bailout?
What I've said to him is that I'm surprised. I respect Secretary Paulson. I think he's been a very good influence here in trying to break through an ideological rigidity in this administration. But what he's saying there is really a greater attack on the integrity and patriotism even of corporate executives than you usually get from the far left. Here's what he's saying. This is an essential program. It is important for the functioning of our economy to avoid disaster that we do it. But if we tell executives that they're going to get a few million less in addition to the millions they all already have, they're going to boycott the program. Is he telling me that they are so greedy and so focused first and foremost on having $89 million instead of $72 million in their own package that they're going to boycott this? I don't believe that. Here's what he's telling us, that, look, these people made mistakes. They weren't bad people in most cases. A few maybe should be prosecuted. But they made mistakes. There was a systemic problem. Because they made mistakes, we've got to put taxpayer money at risk. They can't tell us that while the taxpayer's money is at risk, because we do hope a lot of this is going to be repaid when we ultimately sell the assets, that they can continue to lavish these funds on themselves. So we're saying no golden parachutes on your way out, and you have to let the shareholders vote. This is something the House already did. So, again, I think he's making a very negative judgment about the chief executives if he says that they're going to put maximizing their own personal income ahead of what he tells us is necessary for the country.
Well, certainly there will be challenges in working out those details. As far as responsibility is concerned, here's a question directly for you, Congressman Frank.
Yeah, my name is John O'Brien. I want to ask Barney Frank how much responsibility he takes for all this by forcing banks to give loans that to people that would have never qualified under the old standards.
None whatsoever, because I never did that. In fact, I am proud in this case. For several years now, I have been criticizing those who have equated having a good home with home ownership. I have been saying for years that we are making a mistake by ignoring the provision of good rental housing, because there are people in certain income brackets who, in parts of the country like the greater Boston area, New York, are unlikely to be able to own a home. So I have not done that. The second thing I would say is this. There is something called the Community Reinvestment Act that was passed years before I got to Congress, actually 1977. And it does say that banks, only banks, deposit-taking institutions insured by the federal government, have to pay attention to low-income areas. It never compels them to make any specific loan. In fact, a man named Larry Lindsey, who was chief economic advisor to George Bush until they fired him because he told the truth about the cost of the Iraq War. He was on the Federal Reserve, appointed by Ronald Reagan. He wrote us a letter in 1993, 25 years after this law was passed, and said, or 15 years after it was passed, and said, no, that hasn't happened. It hasn't forced them to make any bad loans. And in fact, here's the problem. It was loans made by institutions not covered by the Community Reinvestment Act that caused us this problem. It was the mortgage finance companies.
Congressman, very quickly, Kevin LaCroix from Beechwood, Ohio, asks, what is the end game? We just have about 20 seconds. Can you quickly give us a sense as we look forward to the hearings?
To be honest, not in 20 seconds. We're going to try to do something that's as responsible as possible. But, you know, I can't answer a complicated question like that in 20
But do you think we'll get this done in a couple of days?
Oh, I hope so, if the administration will agree not just to restrictions on compensation, but making sure that we structure this so that we can reduce foreclosures.
Got it. Barney Frank, Congressman from Massachusetts and Chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, joining us from Washington.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Because we would ask no one to explain Endgame in 20 seconds, we've asked the Congressman Barney Frank, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, to continue his discussion with us. He is, of course, in Washington, D.C., and at the center of the bailout negotiations taking place between the administration and Congress. Congressman Frank, here's a question from North Dakota for you.
Good morning. This is Troy calling from North Dakota. And a question for Barney Frank is, how can executive conduct be legislated so that extreme greed with catastrophic consequences can be fairly punished as a criminal act?
It's a very good question. We can't, of course, do anything now, given the American constitutional principles that I support, legislatively, retroactively. That is, there are things that people did that shouldn't have been legal that, unfortunately, because of this philosophy of non-regulation, were legal. I can guarantee you, going forward, we are going to see many more regulations so that many of the things that got us into this trouble will not be legal going forward. One area has already happened. Look, a large part of this came from subprime loans being made, not by banks, again, not by institutions covered by the Community Reinvestment Act, by the obligation to be socially responsible, but by mortgage finance companies and others, unregulated. And here's the key point. In 1994, the Congress, the last time the Democrats were in control, because there are partisan differences in approach here, Congress passed a law giving the Federal Reserve the power to regulate the granting of mortgages by institutions other than banks. In other words, the unregulated institutions. Alan Greenspan explicitly refused to use the authority given to him. He said, the market knows more than I can't do that. Had Alan Greenspan acted on that authority, we would not be in this crisis. It really is that clear cut. Chairman Bernanke, to his credit, once the Democrats came back into power in 2007 and we began to enact legislation to restrict the granting of these subprime mortgages over Republican opposition, opposition from the Bush administration, Bernanke said, well, yeah, if you're going to do it, I'll do it. And he used the authority that Greenspan refused to use earlier this year to ban these subprime mortgages. So one thing we know is they won't happen again. Secondly, we are going to pass some rules that prevent the non-banks, the hedge funds, private equity, whatever investment banks may still be left because they've sort of been dropping, from engaging in this kind of irresponsible behavior. Now, an administration different than this one would probably find some people to prosecute because of fraud and abuse.
And we understand now that the FBI is taking a look, particularly at some of the major companies at the heart of some of the market troubles. But let me ask you something that's really seemed unusual and has been noted by some of our listeners and others is the bipartisan nature of the criticism of this bailout. How are those discussions, do you think, going to move forward, where in this case, in the House, you have both Democrats and Republicans on the same side?
Well, look, it's very close to an election. And when you let a problem fester, there is not an easy or popular answer to it. And I understand that people who are up for reelection, as we all are in the House within 6 weeks, not wanting to do this. People say, well, wait a minute, I didn't cause this problem. On the other hand, some of the people who are complaining did cause the problem. Apparently, on the Republican side, there's a lot of objection here, but these were the people who rejected our efforts to restrict subprime mortgages and who objected to the notion we had that we should regulate hedge funds. On the Democratic side, what we are saying is this: look, we understand how we got into this problem. If we add some protections for the average citizen here, we may do it. So we are talking about having the government buy up some of this paper in a way that will put us in a position to reduce foreclosures, which is important not just for the individual, but for the neighborhoods and for the cities, very important to the mayors. We are talking about, as we said, right, restricting executive compensation, but also Speaker Pelosi and Senator Reid are saying to them, look, we need a stimulus package because, you know, we got a big problem, this economy, over and above this. We have 6% unemployment, right, and it's rising. We are talking about some money to help with infrastructure, to help pay medical bills, to help pay heating bills. So we're looking for a total package.
Right. Certainly a lot of focus on Congress on all of these economic matters. Congressman Frank, thank you so much for being
with
us this morning.
You're welcome.
Barney Frank, chairman of the House Financial Services Committee, calling us from Washington. There you can see the play by Barney Frank to the constituents and the play by Paulson and Bernanke to the markets, the global markets. There's a real interesting disconnect there. Adora?
And we're going to stay with politics to talk a bit about some advertising. Essentially, an almost new type of attack is emerging, which is ads being used in very specific areas in the country in some of the battleground states. We're talking about ads targeting Barack Obama produced by political action committees that are not connected to John McCain. Joining us for more is the New York Times' Jim Rutenberg. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning to you.
So tell us what's happening in Michigan.
Well, I'm here in Sterling Heights, Michigan, and a group called Freedom's Defense Fund is running cable spots. It's advertisements on the local cable networks here in this town, attacking Senator Obama by linking him to Kwame Kilpatrick, the now resigned mayor of Detroit, and another one linking him to his old pastor, Reverend Wright.
And so what's the subtext for this? I mean, first of all, we've never seen much evidence that Barack Obama and Kwame Kilpatrick were ever terribly close, not like, say, Deval Patrick, the governor of Massachusetts, and Barack Obama, who are very close.
Well, local Democrats say the subtext is race. Jennifer Granholm, the governor here, has made the assertion straight out. The group itself says this isn't about race. They're going to do ads about two other associates of Obama's who are not black. That's Tony Rezgo, the disgraced developer, and William Ayers, the former Weather Underground leader. However, they do say they have a last ad that will have to do with Obama's supposed connection to Prime Minister Odinga of Kenya, which is sort of a conspiracy theory that's been bouncing around there on the internet.
So who is the Freedom's Defense Fund, and who's involved, and what kind of financial backing do they have?
Well, they have as a consultant Jerome Corsi, the author of the book Obamanation, which has been widely panned as being packed with inaccuracies. And they also have as a treasurer a guy who had worked with the Reagan campaign, but later the Buchanan campaign, Scott McKenzie. To be fair, also he worked for Jack Kemp's 88 campaign. And basically it's sort of tied to this direct mail firm that works with a couple of these groups. This group doesn't have a ton of money, and again, this is a PAC.
A PAC, of course, is a political action committee. Thank you, Jim Rutenberg, reporting for the New York Times from Michigan. And now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's going to hit us with, I don't know, maybe three headlines, Femi?
Thanks, Adora. You can count them as I do them. 29 minutes past the hour. President Bush says he's confident Congress will pass the proposed financial bailout, but many lawmakers still insist on changes. Fed Chair Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson are to testify before the House today. Billionaire Warren Buffett is buying a $5 billion stake in Goldman Sachs. Congress has decided to allow a 25-year ban on offshore drilling to expire. And in baseball, the Red Sox beat the Cleveland Indians 5-4 last night, and that wins them a spot in the playoffs. It also bumps the New York Yankees out of a postseason play for the first time in 13 years. One, two, three, four, five headlines. How's that for efficiency?
You're swift. Mm. Thanks,
yes.
Femi.
You're welcome.
Stop gloating about the Red Sox.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, probing topical issues such as mothers who meet at a bar for drinks and bring their babies. Is it fair to the other patrons? Is it fair for bars to prohibit them? Conversations found at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. In about 30 minutes or so, the Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, along with the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, will be on Capitol Hill trying to convince members of the House to back their $700 billion bailout for Wall Street. Lots of criticism about this plan. There's lots of obstacles for lawmakers to hammer through. But what's your thought? Do you believe that the government can fix our economic problems? Have you lost faith?
Good morning. This is Troy calling from North Dakota. And I would have greater faith in Washington if it would change to evidence three major themes. Number one, true bipartisan cooperation in the legislative process. Number two, demonstrating true respect for political opponents by ending hostile rhetoric and negative campaigning. And number three, by revolutionizing political campaigns so that candidates are not beholden to big donors like special interest groups and wealthy corporations.
I think Troy is asking for a lot.
I think Troy's running for something. You can tell us your story.
Thank you, Troy, for your thoughts. Yeah. We'd like to hear what you think. 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can always drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
For whatever reason, the courts have moved into international law to a degree that's relatively unprecedented in our time, whether it's because our global interconnected world makes international law more relevant to day-to-day affairs in the United States, or if the courts are doing something preemptive and aggressive on their own. New York Times writer and Harvard Law professor Noah Feldman argues that the court is, in fact, moving into international relations in a way that is making new doctrine and new law with implications in the United States and around the world. His piece that comes out this weekend is called When Judges Make Foreign Policy. Professor Noah Feldman, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Let's just get right to the point of your article, which is a fascinating elaboration of a lot of trends that have been taking place on the court for a whole variety of reasons. There are two doctrines here, one liberal and one conservative. Could you lay them out briefly, please?
You bet. The liberal view says that the reason we have a constitution is certainly to provide the rule of law, but it's not just to provide rights and the rule of law for us in this country. It's to set an example for the rest of the world, and it's to send a message to the world that the point of law is that everybody should be governed according to their rights, no matter where they might be, whether they're American citizens here or whether they're foreigners whom we encounter abroad or whether they're people living in their own countries.
So in a sense, there's some sort of intent, constitutional intent, that bleeds into the values and notions of freedom around the world outside of the United States.
That's right, and it's based on the idea that the rule of law wouldn't be especially wonderful if all it did was provide rights for some people and not for other people.
Got it.
Meanwhile, the view that tends to be the more conservative view says, look, we the people made this Constitution, and we made it for ourselves. And when we wrote that Constitution, the idea was not, originally at least, to provide rights for everybody else. In fact, it was to essentially protect ourselves and provide for our own common defense. So the Constitution provides rights for us. But when the time comes for us to interact with the rest of the world, we should, pursuant to our constitutional values, be primarily concerned about our own interests and not about other people out there in the world. And if we don't do that, to make matters worse, according to this view, we're actually not respecting democracy. We have to listen to what the people want, and what the people want in our country is to protect their own rights. So if we're encountering foreigners when we're at war abroad, we shouldn't allow courts to hear their claims. We should be concerned primarily about our own self-protection.
So how has the court moved into this? I mean, certainly September 11th has created a lot of issues that the court has had to deal with. But what evidence is there that the court is aggressively moving in this direction and actually making foreign policy, as your title would suggest?
When it comes to the decisions that the court is going to make, there's just so much ducking that the court can do. So consider, for example, the status of the people who were held on Guantanamo as suspected terrorists. The Supreme Court tried for several years not to weigh in to their case. And then once it did start weighing in, it started cautiously saying to the Bush administration, look, go back to Congress and make sure that Congress really wants you to keep these people in Guantanamo. And each time the administration did that, Congress responded by saying, yes, go ahead, keep them in Guantanamo, don't give them constitutional rights. And finally, this past June, the Supreme Court weighed in and said, we don't care what Congress says, we don't care what the president says, we think the people in Guantanamo who have never been to the United States and have not been held in the United States still deserve constitutional rights, despite the fact that there was very little in the existing constitutional precedent that would have dictated that result. So that's one example of where the court did finally weigh in, and in a big way, much beyond what it had done previously.
Do you think that the things that you describe in your article, and I want to hold you into the next segment for a few minutes to actually get into some more details in a moment, but
sure.
Do you think, just before we go to a break, that what the court has begun to deal with in the Bush administration has really opened an almost century-long kind of view of international relations that the consequences of which we're not going to know for a long, long time.
Yes, I think that the bottom line is that we're going to get a lot of swing justices appointed by the next president. And it's not just going to be about domestic affairs or abortion rights, though those are, of course, hugely important. It's also going to be about how our Constitution makes us relate to the rest of the world. And the next justices who are chosen are going to determine that for the future.
Where does the court stand on this conservative international doctrine versus the liberal, and how do the justices break down?
It's split down the middle. You have the four relatively reliable liberals on the side of saying we should be open to the rest of the world. You have the four relatively reliable conservatives saying that we should be concerned with our own interests. And then in the middle, you have Justice Anthony Kennedy, who, with the retirement of Justice O'Connor, has become the swing voter on so many issues. And he's on both sides of the issue. He has voted, he voted in the Guantanamo case to apply constitutional rights there. But in another case, which received less attention this past year, he voted to reconsider the way the United States interprets international treaties to make it much harder for those treaties to be part of the law of the land, as the Constitution, at least in its text, requires them to be.
Noah Feldman, New York Times Magazine contributing writer, author, and Harvard Law professor. And we're going to take a break and get some headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. Just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Financial markets showed some upward mobility today after Warren Buffett announced he's investing $5 billion in Goldman Sachs. That must have offered some relief to one former Goldman Sachs CEO, Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson. He's set to appear before Congress again today with Fed Chair Ben Bernanke to argue for the bailout plan. President Bush gave his farewell address to the UN General Assembly yesterday. He assured world leaders that the US economy is on the mend. John McCain and Sarah Palin are also in New York. They will meet with several world leaders at the UN today. And Barack Obama is still in Florida. He has no public events as he's preparing for Friday night's debate. Galveston residents are making their way back home, and this is official Danny Weber. He says that Galveston is prepared.
We'll have this island ready for residents to come back. We'll not be 100%, but we'll be in good enough shape for our residents to come back.
Residents who do return are being asked to bring their own water, gasoline, first aid kits, and be prepared for snakes and rats. The UN's nuclear watchdog agency says that North Korea is making good on threats to resume its nuclear program. They say that North Korea plans to start reinserting nuclear material into its Yongbyon reactor within a week. And finally, is flying a plane so easy? The FAA suspended two pilots who slept through the landing procedure in Hawaii. They were fired by Hawaii's Go Airlines after they fell asleep on a flight from Honolulu to Hilo.
Why?
In February.
How can you
That's
fall
unfair.
Asleep?
That's totally unfair.
Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
How did I fall asleep?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And continuing now with the Harvard Law professor, Noah Feldman, who's writing a piece on the Supreme Court and foreign policy in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. We were talking in the break about, you know, doctrines of international law and how they stand in this breakdown of the court. Adora, you had a question about the Geneva Convention.
Professor, I just had a question about the fact that despite where an individual justice might stand on the theories that you laid out for us, there are some times where international law, international perception or thought is forced upon the court. And wouldn't the Geneva Convention be one of those examples? And how do you see, based on your theory here, how do you see that's evolved or hasn't evolved, or what your thoughts are on how the Supreme Court deals with it?
That's a wonderful example. On the one hand, you'd think that the court would have no choice but to apply the Geneva Convention. After all, we've signed it. On the other hand, if you read the Geneva Convention, nowhere in there does it explicitly say that the countries who signed it are obligated to apply it in their own courts. In fact, it doesn't say at all how it's enforced. It's one of those conventions that you promise to follow as a country, but there's no court that interprets it internationally, and there's no obligation under the terms of the Geneva Convention explicitly to explain how you would follow it.
And indeed, the Bush administration made much of the fact that it's totally vague when it was at issue in the court.
That's also true, yes. But I think in practice, the debate within the Supreme Court has been, do we apply the Geneva Convention in our own cases when people come before the court, like the Guantanamo detainees, and say, what about our Geneva Convention rights? And half the court has consistently said, no, we don't. There's nothing in the Geneva Convention that makes us do it. And the other half of the court, specifically Justice Stevens, who's been the most articulate voice on the liberal side, has made the following argument, and it's a bit lawyerly, but I think it's relatively easy to follow. He says, if the United States is going to rely on any part of the Geneva Convention, if we're going to say that we're going to detain people as prisoners of war under the Geneva Convention, then we have to follow the entirety of the Geneva Convention to the letter.
Hmm.
So that's
so
the way that he... If you're going to use it, then you got to use it all the way.
Sort of a law of the land constitutional principle. Well, in the minute and a half before we have to say goodbye to you, we know the conservative justice position of Scalia you mentioned. Mm-hmm. What is the sort of liberal position, and how far does it go? I mean, does it grant standing of the Bill of Rights to virtually anyone in the world?
I wouldn't go that far, no. But what it has said is that when you're in a place that the U.S. controls, even if that's not in the United States, the Constitution is still going to apply there.
So if a cop puts their hand on you and it's a U.S. marshal anywhere in the world and has control over your person, suddenly the Bill of Rights is there protecting you as well.
Again, the court hasn't gone quite that far, although that's a direction in which they're tending. What they've said instead is that in a place like Guantanamo Bay, which is not in the U.S., it's in Cuba, but where we exercise, in effect, control, we're just going to act as though we're actually in the United States. And that's a step in the direction that some liberals would like of extending the Bill of Rights, as you say, anywhere where a U.S. police officer arrests you and controls you. Hmm. So we're not quite there yet, but it's conceivable that we can head in that direction.
And lastly, is there any period in U.S. history where the court has been similarly forced to deal with international issues like this? Any period in history?
Yeah. In 1898, when we were thinking about becoming an international global power, and then in the Spanish-American War a couple of years later actually acquired Guam, the Philippines,
right,
and Puerto Rico, the court had to decide whether the Constitution would follow the flag to those new territories.
It all goes back to Teddy Roosevelt, doesn't it? Everything's
it sure
Teddy
does.
Roosevelt.
Everything goes back to Teddy Roosevelt.
Harvard Law Professor Noah Feldman, his piece, When Judges Make Foreign Policy, is in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. We begin with headlines from Femi Oke.
Thank you very much, John. Good morning. The Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson are back on Capitol Hill today to tell skeptical House members why they must pass the Bush administration's $700 billion bailout plan. Now, there's been so much news about the economy, you would almost forget that we're in the political campaign season, but not quite. Here's John McCain's take on the bailout plan. Or maybe not.
Well, John McCain forgot, apparently, that it was the campaign season. Yes,
but
I know.
Who would have thought? Both John McCain and Barack Obama are pretty much both on the same page.
Well, they're scrambling to get plans together because the debate is going to be all about this, even though it's about foreign affairs.
Technically, it's supposed to be about foreign affairs.
It's not,
but we'll see how derailed they get. And meanwhile, the news that was made overnight coming in this morning, the FBI is investigating the four major U.S. financial institutions whose collapse helped trigger that bailout plan. And another 24 or so companies are also under investigation. The Finnish government says that yesterday's shooting at a vocational school may lead to a ban on private gun ownership. And Senator John McCain's campaign manager, Rick Davis's lobbying firm, received $15,000 a month for several years from Freddie Mac. The payments ended just last month.
Interesting. Nothing derails Femi. Okay, thank you, Femi.
Oh, you're welcome.
John?
Yes.
You were going to ask.
Oh, right, right, right. Yeah,
something?
Confidence in the U.S. government. That's right. We were talking about that all hour, particularly with Barney Frank and some others. Either because of this crisis or another, have you lost faith in the government? And what would it take to restore your confidence in government? Barack Obama says he wants to make government cool again. What do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Sorry about that.
That is okay. And we're going to change gears here. And we're going to go to the Amazon, where there is an epic culture clash involving missionaries, the Brazilian government, and ancient tribes that for centuries have had little contact with the outside world. It's a story being covered by ABC's Dan Harris. It was a story that will air tonight on Nightline. He is with us in the studio here in New York, and I don't think I could say anything better to introduce this very complicated story. Let's start first with the traditions in these villages that are days away from any big city and have had such little contact with the outside world.
Well, good morning, first of all, and thank you for having me. The tradition that is at the center of this controversy is infanticide. Everybody who on both sides of this controversy stipulates to the fact that Indians way out in the jungle, sometimes days away from the nearest town, have for centuries, perhaps millennia, practiced infanticide. That means that when a baby is born who is severely deformed, sometimes that baby will be killed by the mother. This is defenders of the practice. There are actually no defenders per se, but people who defend the Indians will say that this is done because these children cannot survive out in the jungle.
Because their life is so simple and
absolutely,
so much of their survival depends on the health of the members of their community. How did it all come to light? If this has been going on for decades, if not centuries, if not a millennia, in Brazil, why is it now made its way all the way up into the Brazilian legislature where they're now debating a bill as to whether or not to ban infanticide?
Because evangelical Christian missionaries who have for years been working with these Indian tribes in a very controversial way, trying to convert them. Although I should say that the missionaries sometimes deny that they're trying to convert them. Sometimes they don't deny it. They have now taken this issue, and they have started to run with it. They are pushing I'm sorry, that is me. I owe you a huge apology.
Oh, that's live radio. That's okay.
They are pushing this issue with a movie that they have made with an American film director. And they're pushing this issue with the Brazilian government, and they have turned it into a major national and now international issue.
Talk about this movie, because I think we have a bit of a clip from it. Set it up for us.
The movie is made by a guy named David Cunningham, whose father founded a group called Youth with a Mission, which is the largest evangelical Christian missionary group in the world. The Brazilian branch of Youth with a Mission is the group that is now pushing this infanticide issue. This movie is a graphic recreation of an alleged attempted murder of a young girl who was born with a disability.
And the family, the Christian family that adopted her, they participated in this movie. And here's some sound from the adopted mother.
What happened is that, you know, when she was born, she looked normal. But when she was 2 years old, she couldn't walk or talk. What they said about her is that she didn't have a soul, a child soul. She had a kind of monkey soul. That's why she couldn't walk, and her hands, the movements look like, you know, monkey's movements. So they believed that she had no soul.
And what do they believe happened to the then infant toddler little girl?
What do the missionaries believe?
Mm-hmm.
The story told in the movie and by the missionaries is that the little girl, whose name is Hakani, which is the name of the movie, and you can see it on the web as a matter of fact, that she was saved from being buried alive by an older brother who took pity on her. And that older brother sort of protected her out in the forest, although she was shunned by the other members of the tribe and mistreated and beaten. And by the time she was carried out of the jungle at 5 years old on her brother's back and brought to the missionaries who were living not far away, she was totally emaciated and near death. Turns out she had thyroid problems that were treatable. This girl, Hakani, who I met, is now walking and talking and going to school. Now, this is all the missionaries' version of the story. It may
be true,
but there's no way to corroborate it.
And certainly the point that you make is that this notion of severe deformity is a term of art. And in fact, the motivations for actually practicing infanticide are mixed in a kind of a mystical medical sort of melange. But I guess I'm wondering, as a journalist, How did you evaluate the conflict between the missionary culture, the sort of civic culture of Brazil, and these indigenous people who are off in their own communities? Certainly missionaries don't have a spectacular legacy in the Western Hemisphere in their interventions with the contact people.
This is so complicated. It's really one of the most thorny moral issues that I've come across as a journalist, because on the one hand, who can defend the killing of children? Who can defend that? Nobody can, not even the traditional defenders of the Indians. Nobody will say this is a justifiable practice, at least nobody that I spoke to. On the other hand, the missionaries who are now taking this issue and pushing it to the highest of levels,
it's an opportunity for them,
have been accused of a cynical ploy to justify their attempts to convert Indians and in the process destroy their culture. So you've got two very potent arguments.
And how does the government, how has the Brazilian government dealt with this? Obviously not something they really want to jump in the middle of.
The traditional defenders of the Indians have been caught flat-footed, flummoxed, and furious. And what they're doing is mounting a very hard, and some believe sort of ham-handed, pushback against the missionaries. They have put out a report that accuses the missionaries of an extraordinary list of crimes, including kidnapping, illegally taking blood samples, illegally removing children from tribes, hiding their intent to evangelize, bribing tribe members with tools and medicine in order to listen to the gospel, and of making a movie that they say deliberately incites hatred toward the Indians. This has been the pushback
from
the government.
They wanted to just go away. I mean, we've seen these kinds of conflicts with female genital mutilation, the female circumcision controversy. It's a moral issue that governments don't want to get involved with, but in many ways they can't avoid.
Oh, there's no way to avoid it. And so where does this proposal come to ban infanticide? And is it a seriously debated proposal, or is it just something that some felt they had to put forth?
The proposal on the table, being backed by the evangelicals and their allies, is making progress through the legislature. They have proposed a number of things. You don't need to ban infanticide because it's already illegal under the law. What you need to do is try to tell the government that they have to go in there and stop it. And they're also trying to pass laws that would allow it, make it illegal for outsiders to adopt Indians who are thought to be at risk. These proposals are all moving through the legislature. The government has had to respond, and they're now saying, we are reconsidering our stance.
Dan, you've had quite a year. First it was selling children in Haiti, and now you're in the Amazon.
Mr. The Happy Talk
at the middle of the debate
in
about...
In my defense, I never sold any children.
good. So, you know, you do need a hipper ringtone, though, dude.
I definitely need a hipper ringtone. I owe you next time.
Thanks,
the phone
Dan.
Will be left outside.
Dan Harris, always a pleasure to have you.
Pleasure.
That's ABC's Dan Harris with a report that will air on Nightline tonight. It is called Into the Wild, the story about ancient tribes in the Amazon.
We talked with Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank earlier, and he gave us our takeaway.
So we're saying no golden parachutes on your way out.
Talking about corporate executives that may or may not be, whose salaries may or may not be affected by the bailout being debated on Capitol Hill.
And by the way, if you're not sure what you think about the presidential candidates, we've got a new tool for you on Facebook. It's called Who Should I Vote For? You put in three qualities you'd like in your next president, and other Facebook users will tell you who you should vote for. You can also tell us what you're thinking about the presidential elections about this time. Who do you have more faith in on fixing the economy, John McCain, Barack Obama? You can go to our website, thetakeaway.org. You can always give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway